You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And today we're going to, I'm going to be off tomorrow and Friday. Whole long story. Anyhow, I'm going to be off for the next 2 days. And so today, Senator Sanders is going to be with us for our brunch with Bernie in our first hour. So it's going to be a special brunch with Bernie Wednesday. Senator Sanders, greetings.
Good to be with you, Tom. And I know everybody is panicking. They think the week flew by and it's Friday, but it's really not. You still have two more days to go. So
there you go.
It's Wednesday.
Yeah, and it's going to be. And here on the program, David Sirota is going to fill in tomorrow on Carl Frisch on Friday, just as an FYI for our listeners. And if you would like to talk to Bernie, our telephone number 866-987-THOM. We're going to do our national town hall meeting brunch with Bernie right now. So, Senator Sanders, the super committee has a week before they turn into a pumpkin. A lot of news coming out and also some not-so-news, you know, a lot of silences coming out. What's going on?
Well, the answer is I wish I could tell you more. I don't know, and most people outside of the committee don't know. They've been keeping what they do fairly secret. But here's the point, Tom. This issue of what the super committee does and doesn't do is of huge consequence in terms of public policy, and it's of huge consequence in terms of politics. And I must tell you that some of the gossip, and it may just be rumors without truth to them, but I'm not so sure about that, that I've been hearing get me very nervous. And what we have to remember is that the last three times that the Democrats negotiated with the Republicans, in almost every instance, they gave the Republicans virtually everything that they wanted. In December, remember, a year ago December, Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, the White House, and not only did they extend Bush's tax breaks for the wealthy, but they also provided new tax breaks in terms of the estate tax for the very, very richest people in this country.
Right.
Republicans got everything they wanted. In April, with the Democrats controlling the Senate and the White House, the Republicans, as everyone remembers, threatened to shut down the government, and the Democrats went along with $78 billion in cuts from the president's budget request, hurt a whole lot of people, and it was just not good. In August, in an outrageous display of unprincipled gamesmanship, the Republicans, for the first time in the history of this country, were prepared to not have America pay our bills, default, and the Democrats caved in there as well, providing $2.5 trillion deficit reduction package. And where we are right now is the committee is looking at up to a trillion and a half, maybe even more. Now, what we are hearing, which makes me very nervous, is Democrats have placed on the table, and this is what I hear. I won't swear to it, but what we hear is they have put on the table cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. We heard really coming up with something very, very vague in terms of revenue, including extending Bush's tax breaks for the rich, but trying to deal with some loopholes in between. But when you talk about revenue, what you've got to remember is you can get revenue from the middle class and the working class and not just for the wealthy. So I think clearly what we have been seeing in the last few months through Occupy Wall Street, through the very strong election results a week ago from Tuesday, where right-wing extremism all over this country was defeated, huge victory in Ohio, the American people have been very clear. They are very clear about what they want, and poll after poll says it. Don't cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Demand that the wealthiest people in this country, whose effective, i.e. real tax rate, is the lowest that it has been in decades, start paying their fair share of taxes, end outrageous corporate loopholes so that you don't have, you know, many, many large profitable corporations paying nothing in taxes, occasionally getting rebates from the IRS. So you have all of that sitting out there. You have a military budget that has tripled since 1997. And I think there really is a consensus, not just among Democrats, independents, many Republicans as well, that we cannot move toward deficit reduction on the backs of the middle class, working class, people who are already been devastated, are struggling to keep their heads above water. Now, will the Democrats on the supercommittee get that message? That remains to be seen. But I would hope very much that every listener here gets on the phone, calls up their members of Congress and the House and the Senate, members of the supercommittee, and say, hey, you got to stand tall. The American people want you to stand tall, demand that the wealthiest people in this country are doing phenomenally well, start paying their fair share of taxes, end these corporate loopholes, take a hard look at military spending, protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That's what we've got to do.
Yeah, and wow. You and I both say despair is not an option. Right? I mean, it's the constant mantra that we've got to get out there and we've got to shake these things up and we've got to tell these Democrats to behave like Democrats. And yet, it seems like they constantly shoot themselves in the foot. Is there anything beyond, you know, calling their offices? I mean,
we're going to be doing tomorrow. Yeah. I will be participating in a public meeting with some other senators. We expect hundreds of senior citizens who are going to come in here and say, hey, we're hurting.
Yeah.
Do not cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And, you know, you're seeing that type of activity all over the country. But, you know, I don't get sometimes where the Democrats come from, because the American people are very clear. To do what I've just suggested is not an act of great political courage.
Right.
It is simply doing what the American people want. I don't have the political courage to go back home and say, oh, by the way, I voted to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and we're really not going to ask the wealthiest people to pay their fair share. That's an act of courage, because the vast majority of the people disagree with you. So, you know, why anybody would want to do that from a public policy point of view, look, let's never, ever forget, we're in the worst, worst recession since the 1930s. It is a horror show out there. You got 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, 16% of our population, kids graduating college, deeply in debt, older workers losing their jobs, may never have another job, pensions being cut, 50 million people without health insurance. No, you don't go after the middle class and working class.
Right.
The richest people in this country are doing phenomenally well. We have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income. Those are the people who finally have got to sacrifice. And here's the crazy irony, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
After the first three agreements that were reached, guess how much more the rich have been asked to pay in taxes?
Zero.
Not a penny.
Yeah.
How much more large corporations have been asked to pay? Not a penny.
Right.
I mean, this is literally beyond comprehension.
Yeah. In the minute before the break, let's flip it to the other end of the age spectrum. Student debt, for the first time in the history of this country, is about to equal credit card debt, $1 trillion. What can we do about it?
It is a very sad situation. I did some town meetings on a couple of college campuses in Vermont a few weeks ago. Young lady gets up there, tears streaming down her eyes. First person in her family to go to college, saddled with a huge debt, doesn't know how she's going to find a job to pay for it. We need the president and the Congress to say, look, we asked you to go to college. We need you to get the education that you need in order to be good workers in the 21st century in a highly competitive society. No, we're not going to bury you in debt. We are going to address that issue. And there are things that you can do about it.
Yeah, it seems vitally important. So it's our Brunch with Bernie hour today. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Your calls for Bernie, 866-987-THOM, or anything you'd like to weigh in on and share with Bernie, with Senator Sanders. We'll be right back. His website, by the way, sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
866-987-THOM. We'll be right back.
Of course, we will continue every effort to end monopoly in business, to support collective bargaining, and to abolish dishonorable trade practices. And we have only just begun to fight.
Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our Brunch with Bernie hour 2 days early. Wednesday. Today we have Senator Sanders on and taking your calls. Bernie, you're still here. You're all ready to go?
I am right here, Tom.
Okay. Joe in Toledo, Ohio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Today, the money lenders, the people who sell bonds to nations, announced that they're going to raise the interest rates on countries like Sweden that don't actually have much debt. They're not even using the excuse of debt anymore. Given what happens to these countries when these corporations raise the interest rates, it looks pretty much to me like they're trying to take over the world one country at a time, and we are undoubtedly on that list somewhere. We're going to have to make a stand at some point and just tell them that they cannot raise interest rates unreasonably. How can we do this before it's too late, before they do this to the United States of America?
Well, you know, Joe, in for individuals, not the federal government or state or local government, interest rates are already off the wall. At a time when interest rates in general are so low, the idea that people are paying 25 or 30% interest rates on their credit cards from the large banks is beyond comprehension. It is, to my mind, usurious. It is immoral, and it should be made illegal. It's an issue we have tried to work on. I think what you're also touching on, Joe, which is a huge issue, and nobody should think that it's going to be solved tomorrow because you're taking on the most powerful people in the world. You have, just in this country alone, your top six financial institutions having assets worth 65%, the equivalent of 65% of the GDP of America, $9 trillion, six financial institutions. These people have enormous economic power, enormous political power. Now, I think the Occupy Wall Street people have done a great job in focusing attention on issues like this. But for a start, and we're going to work on this, not getting a lot of support, you know, here in the Congress, we've got to start breaking up these huge financial institutions. There's got to be some competition out there in the financial marketplace. Wall Street has got to return to what banking principles are about, investing in the productive economy, creating real jobs in America, and not running the world's largest gambling casino. So, Joe, you're touching on an issue of enormous consequence. I think that is what Occupy Wall Street has been touching on. We need a mass movement for a progressive agenda, and that includes absolutely radical changes in the way the financial institutions in this country and around the world operate.
Corey in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hey, Corey. You're on the air with Bernie.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Hey, thank you for having me on. Real quick question. I had an idea for what I call the Robin Hood Act, which I think, you know, it'd be cool if people in Congress or, you know, the Democrats in Congress try to put forth a bill that gives big corporations an ultimatum to either roll back things to how they used to be, where CEOs only made, you know, a 12 to 1 differential, or if they're not going to do that, to pay a much higher percent in income taxes. And could anything like that be done?
Well, actually, Corey, there has been legislation introduced which deals with that issue. And it says that if the discrepancy between the CEO and the worker is above X percent, and I can't remember exactly what it is, among other things, companies could not deduct for taxable reasons those kinds of expenses and other expenses as well. So I think you're right. One of the outrages that we see in the economy right now is not just the growing gap between the very rich and everybody else, but in many of these large corporations, you have CEOs making hundreds of times what their workers are making. When they leave, they get these golden parachutes, while at the same time companies are cutting back on pensions and health care benefits for their workers. So I think Corey is onto something very important.
Adam in Silver Spring, Maryland. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, Senator Sanders. It's an honor to talk to you. I would like to know how you feel about investigating the Bush administration for war crimes.
Well, I tell you, Adam, there is a lot of things that we could investigate about the Bush administration. I think as somebody who obviously voted and fought against going to war in Iraq, the way that war was presented, the belief on the part of many people that Bush wanted to go to war in Iraq and use 9/11 as a ploy, in a sense, to get public support for going to war against a country which had nothing to do with 9/11. But I have to tell you something, Adam. From a political point of view, right now, this country is dealing with massive unemployment, 50 million people without health care. We are dealing with two wars, a huge national debt. So I would not place, I would say the public would say, hey, give me a break. You got real problems facing the working class and middle class today. You know, what Bush did is probably not going to be on the top burner.
Damon, in Clinton Township, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is about this whole the health care decision that's going to be coming up with the Supreme Court. It was reported that the day before they were to make the decision whether they're going to hear this, the two of the justices were wined and dined by the opposition of the bill, and they're still going to hear this case. It just doesn't seem they should recuse themselves, but there's nothing we can do as voters about this. They're going to hear the case, and it seems like they're obviously going to vote in the opposition's favor, and I just think that's wrong. This is the Supreme Court. They're supposed to be loyal and righteous.
Damon, we'll have to pick up Bernie's response to that. If that's okay with you, Bernie?
Yes.
On the other side of the break, I missed the cue that the break was coming. My apologies. And we'll be right back. More with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, 2 days early today on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Sanders, it's Wednesday. Yes, it really is. And Bernie, we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. It's marvelous. We'll be right back.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on. Go play.
Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, 2 days early. It's Wednesday, but we're talking with Bernie today. And Russell, in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom.
Oh, hey, Russell, let me put you on hold. Bernie was going to answer the last question, Damon's question.
Well, I think what Damon raises more profoundly is the, you know, we have a Supreme Court out here that basically elected Bush president, that passed the outrageous Citizens United decision, probably the worst Supreme Court decision in the modern history of this country, making corporations into people. And on they go. Are there conflicts of interest? I'm not on the Judiciary Committee, and I really have not studied it, but I think you certainly can make a case, and this is an argument I think that should be pursued.
Okay. And so now let's get back to Russell. Russell, your chance to talk with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, there's going to be a group of citizens, doctors, groups who believe there should be a single-payer system, who are going to file amicus with the Supreme Court, calling on the Supreme Court to declare Obamacare unconstitutional, because we believe that, I'm one of them, I believe, and these other doctors, PNHP doctors and so forth, believe that you can't constitutionally force people to buy junk insurance from these giant health insurance corporations as Obamacare does. And we want it obviously replaced with a single-payer system, so do you. But I'm wondering if you will join us in signing on to this amicus brief to call on the Supreme Court to declare it unconstitutional so we can clear the way for a single-payer system.
Russell, I won't. And the reason is, I, as you know and as you've indicated, I'm a strong advocate of single-payer. I hope Vermont will lead the country into single-payer. I do not think that tactic is going to get you single-payer. I think you're going to need a strong grassroots movement all over this country. And I think that the and I'm a great fan, and I've spoken with many of the people in the Physicians for National Healthcare Program, and they're doing a phenomenal job. I think this tactic is, lining up with the right wing is probably not a good a tactic. It is not going to lead to a single payer. The only way you are going to get a single payer is if a state like Vermont goes forward. If it works, other states will go forward, and we're going to do our best to see that happen. I want to see other states go forward with single payer. We have to keep the movement going for single payer nationally. But I will tell you, as somebody who has introduced the single payer bill, it was filibustered. I didn't get a chance to get a vote on it. I doubt I would have gotten more than 7 or 8 votes. So you need a grassroots movement that says health care is a right. The current system is dysfunctional. 50 million people uninsured, and yet we spend almost twice as much as any other nation on earth that provides health care to all. These are the arguments that Physicians for National Health Care have been making, but I would not be supportive of that tactic.
Hollis in Fair Oaks, California. Hollis, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I'm a real estate broker in California, and what I have learned is that Freddie Mac is preventing buyers of short sale properties where they guaranteed the loan from renting to the former owner. And I have two questions. The first one is, since when did the federal government or a private corporation have the right to tell me, let's say it's me as a landlord, who I can rent to? And number two, can you do something about this?
That's a very good question, Hollis. I think you're right on your first point. You know, we are seeing, I mean, just so many people being thrown out of their homes where an agreement could have been reached, which would have been better for the individual and better for the bank. And that's what you're talking about. And that is something that we should be working on. There is some work on that. The president has come up with some ideas, but we've got to go a lot further than that.
John in Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. My question is about the Grover Norquist pledge. I'm wondering, that's a pledge to the Republican Party, not to the constituents. What's the difference between that pledge and the pledge that Adolf Hitler asked his countrymen to sign in 1932? Aren't they both pledges for support? Aren't they the same thing?
No, John, I don't think they are. I mean, I think what Norquist has proposed and what many Republicans, vast majority, have agreed to is pretty stupid. We have the wealthiest people in this country paying the lowest percentage effective tax rate in the modern history of this country. Our revenue as a percentage of GDP is the smallest that it has been in decades. Of course, we have to raise taxes, especially on the wealthy and large corporations, and that you have so many Republicans who have signed on to this absurd pledge is beyond pathetic. But I think this is what politics is about. These people make their decisions. And by the way, what I'm beginning to see is Mr. Norquist is there's a little bit of a rebellion against him, I think, because the American people do believe that the wealthiest folks in this country should start paying their fair share of taxes. But, you know, I think what he does is you know, and during the campaign, he said, look, I want you to sign this. You don't have to. I want you to do it. And then he puts political pressure on anybody who does who breaks the pledge. So I think this is what politics is about. I think it's a dumb idea, but I wouldn't compare it to Hitler.
Elena in Seattle, you're on with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. This is Elena. I saw on my local news last night there was a story about chemotherapy drugs not being able to be obtained by local hospitals due to the drug companies basically not making enough money on products that have been out there for a long time, and a lot of them are generic. Can you address that issue?
Yes, that's been a problem that we have seen in this country now for a number of months. It is obviously unacceptable. What has happened is if there's a shortage in the drugs, if the companies are not producing it, prices skyrocket. Working people can't necessarily afford those drugs, and that is clearly wrong. Elena, what I can tell you is, you know, the drug industry, pharmaceutical companies, year after year after year, are extremely profitable. They charge the American people in general the highest prices in the world. We have seen situations now where the drug companies are doing their best to prevent generics for AIDS and other illnesses for third world countries, which would cost a tiny fraction of what the brand medicine costs. So these are tough guys whose bottom line is to make as much money as they can. I'm afraid that they have a whole lot of power here in Washington. They very rarely lose, but this is an issue where we should fight them as hard as we can.
It's Justin in Orange County, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders with Bernie.
Senator Sanders, it's an honor. Thanks for taking the call. My question is, in 2006, the Republican Congress and President signed into law a bill regarding the post office and the funding of their pension plans. And apparently they have to, they're forced to fund their pension plans 75 years in advance, or I mean outward. Which, you know, a report this morning, the post office has lost $5.1 billion to date this year. Now, if you backtrack and look at the stats on it, they were profitable all the way up until this bill was passed. And is there anything happening in, you know, the Senate or the House to, you know, repeal this bill or to get it back under control? Because
yes.
75 years out, I mean, they're going to be funding pension plans for people that aren't even born yet. And it seems absolutely ludicrous. And, you know, is it just a veiled attempt by the Republicans to break the union and to get rid of something that works good for government? I don't really understand.
All right, Justin, thank you very much for that question. It is a very important issue. Everything you said, to the best of my knowledge, is correct. And it's not only paying a future health care retiree benefits for 75 years out in 10-year period, but there are also other retirement benefit issues that the Postal Service has been forced to pay more into the federal retiree plans than was appropriate. To answer your question, yes, something is being done about this. We held a town meeting in Vermont a week ago Sunday. We had 350 people coming out. It's a great meeting, and people are saying let's make sure that we don't lay off over 100,000 workers in the middle of a recession, many of whom are veterans. Let's give the Postal Service what they do not have right now, the tools to compete in the 21st digital century. They don't have that. They're really restricted in the kind of business model that they can function under. And we have got to deal with these accounting issues that Justin mentioned. I have introduced comprehensive legislation that deals with all of these issues. There are Steve Lynch of Massachusetts in the House introduced a good piece which deals with one part of the accounting issue. So to answer Justin's questions, yes, there are many of us who are trying hard to preserve the Postal Service, to prevent 100,000 jobs being lost, and to give them, make them a 21st century company that can effectively compete.
Bernie, we just have a few seconds left. A quick question. The post office is, well, I'll just say it. You can reply on the other side, I guess. The post office is the second largest employer in the United States. Walmart is number one. And it is the largest unionized employer. I'm wondering if you think that has something to do with why the Republicans went after them.
The answer is yes.
Okay. All right. We don't have to wait on that one. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. Brunch with Bernie here on Wednesday on the Tom Hartman Program. Your calls for Senator Sanders up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. It's an absolutely fabulous news resource.
We have not come thus far without a struggle, and I assure you that we cannot go further without a struggle.
Helping you win the Water Cooler Wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie's hour, 2 days early. Today is Wednesday, and Senator Sanders is with us taking your calls. And Dwayne in Petaluma, California, you're on the air with Bernie.
Thank you. Yes, I read the Constitution, the portion of Article 5 that prohibits the any state from being deprived of equal suffrage in the Senate. And I view that the super committee effectively does that, that the citizens of all the states, including Vermont, have been denied equal suffrage. And I'd like to know what could be done about that, possibly taking the whole idea of a super committee to the Supreme Court.
Well, I mean, number one, I would not have a great deal of confidence in the Supreme Court to do the right thing. Number two, I think these are political decisions. A majority of the members of the House and the Senate, not me, I didn't vote for this thing, voted for the super committee. The issue here, Duane, really is what the supercommittee will end up doing. And I feel very strongly, as I said at the beginning of this program, and I hope everybody is hearing this, that there is a possibility, no one can predict, that the Democrats on the supercommittee will give the Republicans 75, 80, 85% of what they want, which would be not only just horrendous public policy in terms of cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and what that means to Americans, especially in the midst of a recession, but politically, where people are beginning to stand up and say, what, there's something wrong in this country when so few have so much and so many have so little, that we have got to finally stand up and create more equality in America. And if the supercommittee goes in that other direction and the Democrats are part of that politically, I think that's a disaster. So, Duane, I think, like many other issues, there is no magic cure. You know, I dealt with a doctor a minute ago. You know, they're going to go to the Supreme Court. Ultimately, these things will be decided in a democratic society by large numbers of people standing up and saying, excuse me, do not move toward deficit reduction on the backs of people who are unemployed, who have no health insurance, who are suffering economically. Demand that the wealthiest people in large corporations, that the military-industrial complex, that they stop participating in deficit reduction and not just ordinary people. So I don't think there's any magical legal issue that's going to solve it. I think it's a political issue that millions of people have got to engage in.
Stephen in Burbank, you're on with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie. My question is this. How can we create jobs that are productive rather than destructive? We see China making up all the solar panels, and look at all of that fossil fuel being burned to ship them over here. We could build our own solar panels, our own wind turbines. They can build theirs. We can tend to our community gardens. We can have a guaranteed annual income for a decent standard of living and not have to be subject to the power of the elite. How do we get this conversation going about what it is that constitutes a job and what it is that constitutes productivity?
Stephen, thank you for your comments, and I agree with you. And it's like everything else. You know, sometimes, you know, Tom, people call in and they think there's a magical solution. Mm. The Supreme Court is going to make a decision. Everything is going to, you know, be better. That is not the way it works. The Republicans, for 30 or 40 years, using their money, using their media, using their think tanks, have done a very effective job in miseducating the American people. The Democratic Party for years has been much weaker than it should be in terms of standing up for working class and middle class people. And Stephen, what the struggle is about to create meaningful jobs, as you indicated, this is a political issue. Right now, we could not get one Republican vote to put $60 billion into rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. Truth is, we should be spending a whole lot more. As Stephen indicates, we should be building solar panels right here in the United States, create a whole lot of jobs. The cost of solar is going down. It's going to be competitive with the more mature technologies, our energy technologies. Huge potential in job creation, in weatherization, in energy efficiency, geothermal, biomass. It is sitting there waiting to happen. Got to change our trade policies so the corporations are not busy outsourcing our jobs to China and elsewhere and reinvesting in America. We need health care for all of our people. So when you talk about an economy, the economy has got to include the reality that people are entitled to health care, they're entitled to decent housing, that we just don't produce and expand for the sake of producing and expanding, that we create meaningful jobs, protecting our environment, protecting our children, protecting our vulnerable people. Can we do it? Yeah, we can do it. But it requires tens of millions of people being actively involved in a strong political movement around the progressive agenda.
We have just a little over 1 minute left, Bernie, and not enough time to bring in a caller. Thoughts on where we go from here and how we move forward?
Well, we are closing in on D-Day here in terms of the supercommittee. And I hope in any and every way that the American people stand up and say to that supercommittee, Republicans and Democrats, you want deficit reduction, there are fair ways to do it. When you have the top 1% earning more than the bottom 50%, when you have the top 400 people owning more wealth in this country, 400 people, than the bottom 150 million people, the super committee should know where to go to get the money they need to move toward deficit reduction. And what we have got to be very strong about is the Democrats cannot cave in and support any cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. And I would hope that people get onto their computers, start emailing, get on their phones, start calling, because we need that type of grassroots activism at this moment.
Oh, and it seems that in many ways the Occupy movements are starting to promote that. I mean, it's the Tea Partiers, frankly. It's surprising how many of them say don't end Social Security. I think that there is a genuine populist. This is a populist moment.
Yes, there is. And we have got to capture that and make Washington pay attention to what's going on among ordinary Americans and not just the big money interests.
Absolutely. So well said. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
It's always an honor. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, and check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Up next, David Osborne with Occupy Portland. A little later on, Greg Palast will be with us. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And our brunch with Bernie is over for the callers on hold waiting for Bernie. We just finished. We just did an hour with Senator Sanders taking your calls. I want to tell you in this opening segment, and in fact, bring it up for conversation throughout the rest of the program today. What is a revolution and how does a revolution happen? Because I believe that we are at a revolutionary moment in the United States right now, and frankly, around much of the world. And that we are going to see coming out of this an actual revolution. And I don't mean a shooting revolution. I don't mean, you know, you say that word and people think of the Revolutionary War. But there are a lot of revolutions that are very peaceful. And, well, let me just back up a little bit. Yesterday, what got me thinking about this was, you know, let me play this call. This was a caller who called into the show yesterday afternoon around just a little bit before the end of the show. Here he is.
And I challenge anyone to point out how there is a constitutional right to take over public lands and live on them. Just under the name of a protest movement. For instance, would you be happy if a group of pro-lifers went to Zuccotti Park and camped out there for 2 months protesting against abortion, or gun owners going to a park in San Francisco and just pitching a shanty town there and saying they have a constitutional right to actually live there? Nobody's talking about taking away the right to protest and do anything like that. I mean, all you have to do is compare the Tea Party protests. You know, you just contrast the way they protested, the way this Occupy Wall Street group protests, and Occupy Wall Street looked like a bunch of immature children.
Okay, so, and, you know, he asked me, you know, what would you think? And I said, you know, let me think about that. I didn't have an immediate answer. I really wanted to give a considered response. This is that response. If an anti-abortion group or a Tea Party group or a, you know, end the Paris Hilton tax group or whatever, if some group was so passionate about their cause that they were willing to put their bodies on the line and they were willing to occupy a park and stay in it for weeks or months, I would say to them, congratulations. Good on you. More power to you. We have not seen this kind of passion in the United States since 1932, when 45,000 people occupied the space between the front lawn of the White House and the Potomac River here in Washington, D.C. It was called the Bonus Army. And several weeks into that occupation, the President of the United States at that time, Republican Herbert Hoover, ordered General Douglas MacArthur to take 8 tanks and a whole bunch of soldiers on horseback and ride through that camp and smash it up and set it on fire. And they did. And a number of people were injured. And a lot of property was destroyed, and the blowback from that was the revolution of the years that Franklin Roosevelt was president. Four times, Franklin Roosevelt, four times in a row, he was elected president of the United States. The New Deal was the revolution that came out of that. The last Occupy movement. The last Occupy movement was the Bonus Army. And you know, so I would say, you know, good on you. But see, frankly, I don't think that the anti-abortion movement or the anti-tax movement or the you fill in the blanks, the single issue, you know, gun rights, whatever it may be. By and large, I don't think that there is that level of systemic rage, if I may, you know, for lack of a better phrase, you know, of looking at the entire system and saying, you know, I mean, these are like slice rage points or concern points or whatever, but they're not systemic. And it's the systemic stuff that brings about revolutions. Right now in the United States, you have 53 million people without health insurance. You have 44 million Americans living on food stamps. About half of them are kids. You have 49 million Americans living in poverty. That's one out of four children. Only 58% of Americans even have a job. The median yearly wage right now is $26,261 a year. If you take out the top 1% from those numbers, it's probably around $25,000 a year. Who can live on that? Average household debt, therefore, is now $75,000, $75,600. American families today are $7.5 trillion poorer than they were in 2007, before the Great Bush crash. Since 1979, the top 1% have seen their incomes go up 275%, and the bottom fifth have seen their incomes go up only 18%. The top 1% own half of all the stock in the United States. The bottom 50% own one half of 1%. Top 1% own 50%. A typically hourly wage has just gone up $1.23 in the last 36 years. Student debt is approaching $1 trillion. The top 20% in America own 80% of all the wealth in the United States. 400 oligarchs in the United States own more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans. There are 4.2 people looking for every single job that's open right now. The finance and energy industries collect 40% of all federal tax subsidies. Finance, the banksters. 25 million unemployed and underemployed people, 16% of the population. The top six banks have $9 trillion in assets. That's equal to 65% of our GDP. The top 1% earns more than the bottom 50%. How can you acknowledge the reality of statistics and not say, okay, this is a revolutionary moment? This is systemic. This is top to bottom. This is pervasive. This is a rot throughout the system that has been brought to you courtesy of 30 years of Reaganomics. Crane Brinton, in his book Anatomy of a Revolution, lays this out. Chris Hedges wrote a brilliant piece about it. I saw it at Truth Out today. I believe it was originally published. I'm not sure where it was originally published. But in any case, it's over at truthout.org right now. And he says, you know, here are the preconditions for revolution. He's quoting Crane Brinton, this historian who wrote Anatomy of Revolution. He said, number one, you have to have a discontent that affects nearly all the social classes. Number two, feelings of entrapment and despair. Number three, unfulfilled expectations. I've talked many times on this program about the J-curve notion that revolutions happen not because so many people are sick or so many people are hungry or so many people are broke or whatever. I mean, there are countries in the world that are far worse off than the United States that are not even close to revolution. It's not because of that. It's because the gap between what people expect and what they can actually get in their lifetime reaches a certain large point. And once it tips over a particular threshold, that expectation gap, that's when people revolt. That's that unfulfilled expectations that Crane Brinton talks about. When there's a unified solidarity in opposition to a tiny power elite, when there's a refusal by scholars to go along with things, when the inability of the government to meet the basic needs of its citizens is real. And then when the inner circle starts experiencing defections, and finally when there's a financial crisis, that's where we are right now. He wrote, Chris Hedges notes that Clint Crane Brinton in his book Anatomy of Revolution wrote, revolutions always begin by making impossible demands that if the government met would mean the end of the old configuration of powers. The second stage, Chris Hedges writes, the one we have now entered, is the unsuccessful attempt by the power elite to quell the unrest and discontent through physical acts of repression. So that's where it starts. Now, how do you win a revolution? You win a revolution through defections. These defections are advanced through rigid adherence to nonviolence, a refusal to respond to police provocation. And we've seen this in country after country after country, where peaceful demonstrators exposed a system, and it came down.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the fact that you've got, you know, these two people have resigned from Mayor Kwan's office in Oakland, that looks to me like the beginning of a revolution. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. N17 PDX, as in PortlandOregon.org, is the website. It's extraordinary. Occupy the Banks. November 17th, Occupy the Banks. David Osborne is with us with Occupy Portland and Friends Day of Action. And David, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So what's going on?
We are going to be occupying the banks, as you said, tomorrow. In the morning at 8 a.m., we're going to be working with some labor allies, and they're going to be doing an action on the steel bridge to really bring awareness to the need to create jobs and not cuts. People are cutting, the government is cutting the repairs of those bridges, and so they'll be doing an action to bring attention to that, and then they'll be coming to join us at 10 a.m., at Southwest Pine and NATO at Waterfront Park in Portland, Oregon, where we'll be rallying before we march and go into downtown to shut down banks.
Wow. And what is the latest with Occupy Portland? I know, you know, Sam Adams, I know, cleared the park. What has come back? What's going on?
Yeah, so on Saturday evening, at night actually, at 12:01 a.m., the city closed the parks, and they attempted to evict us from the squares at that point. Thousands of people, I've seen as many as 10,000, but certainly at least 6,000 people came out to support us, and it was an extraordinary evening of nonviolent resistance to police force, including charging the crowd with horses. And we were able to keep them from removing us from the square. In the morning, about six city blocks at that point had been blocked off to traffic one way or another. Protesters were in about three of those blocks, including the streets. They asked us to move out of the streets, indicating that we could keep the park if we did so. We immediately complied, and then they came in 3 hours later, arrested 50 protesters, beat several of the protesters, sending one gentleman to the hospital. And so we're now in a stage, a kind of transition stage, where we're regrouping, trying to meet the immediate needs of folks that need a place to stay, and also trying to think about what our long-term strategy is. On November 17th, tomorrow, it's one of many actions that are going to continue to try and grow and engage the thousands of participants that have become involved in this movement, mm-hmm. and really take our message, in this case, to the banks, but also really bring this conversation throughout the city of Portland so that people can begin to talk about how we solve these problems in our society.
Okay. Great. David, thank you for coming on and for sharing it with us. The website for your particular action is n17pdx.org. Of course, in New York, they're going to be marching on Wall Street, on the New York Stock Exchange, and there's other actions happening all over the country. David, good luck.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for dropping by. It's appreciated. And this, as I was saying before the break, this, what you're looking at here, in my opinion, is actually a revolutionary moment here in the United States. And, you know, Chris Hedges has lived through a bunch of these and seen them. I've been on the edge of a few. I was in Budapest, Hungary when the East Berlin Wall fell, And in fact, I was there the week before, and all these East Germans were streaming into Budapest. And that was a remarkable time, because what happened, what precipitated the fall of East Germany, was that the police refused, what was his name, Heinrich Kohl? Erich Honecker was the leader of East Germany. They refused his orders to shoot people. And that's when revolutions actually, peaceful revolutions actually happen. Chris Hedges talks about in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, the same thing in Bucharest. He says, I watched in December, this is Chris Hedges speaking, I watched in December 1989 as the army general that the dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu had depended on to crush protests, condemned him to death on Christmas Day. Tunisia's Ben Ali, Egypt's Hosni Mubarak. When did they lose power? When their security forces would no longer shoot into the crowds. So a revolution happens, first of all, when all those conditions that I described earlier have been met. And not so much that I described, but that Crane Britton described in his book Anatomy of a Revolution, that Chris Hedges brilliantly encapsulates in this piece on truthout.org right now. And probably other places, that discontent affects nearly all the social classes, that feelings of entrapment are widespread and associated with feelings of despair, that there are unfulfilled expectations in society, that there is a unified solidarity in opposition to a tiny power elite, that the scholars and thinkers of the society start refusing to go along with the ruling class, that the government is no longer able to meet the basic needs of its citizens, that within the power elite, there is a sense of crippling isolation, and finally, a financial crisis is what tips it over the edge. And how do you respond? Chris Hedges says, the process of defection among the ruling class and security forces is slow and often imperceptible. But this is where it happens. This is where the revolution actually happens. It starts from the ground up. But he says these defections are advanced through a rigid adherence to nonviolence, a refusal to respond to police provocation, and a verbal respect for the blue uniform police, no matter how awful they can be while wading into a crowd and using batons as battering rams against human bodies. And then he points out how, you know, Mayor Jean Kwan's deputy, Sharon Cornu, resigned over the police riot in Oakland. Her longtime friend and legal advisor, Dan Siegel, resigned and, in fact, tweeted out, support Occupy Oakland, not the 1% and its government facilitators. This is how revolution happens. When you don't get distracted and you don't give in to violence and you expose how corrupt the system is.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And that, in my opinion, is exactly what's happening right now.
They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Yeah, you want to hear some proof. This is the kind of stuff that I'm talking about here. When people no longer trust not just the institutions of power, but the people who hold power, in particular the people who hold power outside of public institutions, but everybody knows they're influencing public institutions. People like, for example, Karl Rove. Listen to this.
By today, it's equal to 70% of GDP.
Karl Rove is the architect of Occupy Iraq. The architect of Occupy Afghanistan.
If you believe in the right of the First Amendment,
the 1%,
then you demonstrate it by shutting up and waiting until the Q&A session.
Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Baltimore. Occupy America! Occupy! Everywhere!
Who gave you the right to occupy America? Nobody!
We're already in America! We are 99%.
This is Karl Rove trying to give a speech in Baltimore. And this is increasingly happening. I mean, this is what you are seeing is the pushing back on power. Now, interestingly, there's a poll, public, you know, public perception, you know, public support, that kind of thing. A poll just came out showing that the public affection for, shall we say, the Occupy movement has actually dropped below that of the Tea Party. It's dropped over the last couple of weeks. And I think that's in part because because of a relentless barrage by right-wing talk radio and by corporate media focusing on, you know, basically let's find the most weird or exotic person we can or, you know, playing basically the dirty hippie card. And that's not what's going on. What's going on is Americans saying, no, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Americans of all ages and races and education, you fill in the blank. Louise just forwarded me a note. This is, don't forget the details. Our parents had careers, not just jobs. It didn't matter if they were working in an office or an assembly line. They had a living wage, decent health insurance, no deductions, no denial of procedures, no money out of your paycheck, and they had pensions. What a novel idea. Part of your wages included a savings plan that was managed by professionals and guaranteed to be there when you retired. Now they want us to put all our savings in that casino called Wall Street through our 401ks. Now we have a pittance called Social Security. The Republicans are determined to take that away also. The Republicans can't even stand the thought of working people retiring with Medicare. They just want us to spend our last penny earned on a Wall Street insurance company that will deny a life-saving procedure. Yes, that's exactly where we're at right now. And the system is imploding. And the people are standing up and saying, no, not going to take it anymore. Because that gap between expectation and reality has gotten so wide. And frankly, it's a gap not just between expectation and reality, but between a clear understanding of what could be and what is. Brought to you by 30 years of Reaganomics. I laid this out a few years back in my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. It basically predicted this was happening. I'm not trying to play some oracle here, but this, I mean, this should be obvious to everybody. So anyhow, some of your thoughts on this. Marcella in Seattle. Hey, Marcella, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Great.
I just learned recently something which you probably already knew, was that someone told me that the Constitution actually has a way for us to go around Congress and call for a people's convention to amend the Constitution. Is that true?
A constitutional convention requires, it's Article 5 of the Constitution. It requires Congress to do it.
It requires Congress to do it. I saw Lawrence Lessig speak at the Seattle Town Hall on his book, Republic Lost, and he said that there actually is a way to kind of sidestep Congress and call for it directly from the people. The states still need to ratify it.
I know Lawrence is out there promoting that. In fact, I debated him on this topic in New York at a coffee party event about a year ago. And Lawrence is promoting that with his book and whatnot. And I think it's a terrible, terrible mistake. If we were to open the Constitution up right now and say, okay, let's make some changes. Who do you think is going to step in with a multimillion-dollar advertising campaign to make sure that the changes suit them?
But the point I was trying to make is just that somehow we have to get the money out of politics. That is the root.
And the simple way to do it. And this was the debate that I had with Lawrence Lessig, and I don't get it. Why? And he and I were in the room, and we literally debated this. And I just for the life of me, I don't understand why anybody would want to say, okay, let's open the Constitution up with a constitutional convention. I mean, you can look at any state that has citizen referendums, and look at the craziness that's been passed.
Yeah.
Like in Oregon, they actually convinced the average citizen to say, oh, sure, the state should not have a rainy day fund. If there's any money left over at the end of the fiscal year, cut a check. It's called a kicker. Cut a check and send it back to, which, of course, benefited the very wealthy, you know, high taxpayers the most. You know, the average person's getting $50 back, but, you know, Phil Knight's probably getting $50,000 or five. Who knows how much? And,
well,
and not to say that he was behind it. So
how do we get the money out of politics?
You pass a constitutional amendment without a constitutional convention. You don't open up the whole Constitution to be rewritten and tinkered with. You pass one simple constitutional convention that says money is not speech and corporations are not people. And
but we have to pass that through a Congress that thinks that money is speech and, you know?
Well, sort of. The fact, I don't know a lot of members of Congress personally. In fact, I don't know any of them personally well enough to say that they're like friends, you know, or that kind of thing.
Right.
But I've certainly talked to a lot of them, and particularly since I've moved here. And even Republicans will tell you, if you ask them in a not for attribution quote, that they are horrified by the fact that out of an 8-hour day, they spend 4 to 5 hours of that day raising money. That every single day, every single senator wakes up knowing they've got to raise $20,000 that day, and every member of the House of Representatives wakes up knowing that they've got to raise anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000 that day, if every single day of their working life, if they're going to get reelected. And even at that, if a Wall Street billionaire decides that they're going to squash him like a bug, they're going to be in deep trouble. They're all horrified by it. I think that if there was a genuine popular support nationwide for a simple amendment that says, corporations are not people and money is not speech. Take it out at the core, right? This is all, this whole corporate personhood thing, this whole money is speech thing, it's all built on one thing. And that is that in the 14th Amendment, which says that no person shall be denied equal protection under the law, the amendment that basically freed the slaves, 13th, 14th, and 15th that freed the slaves. In that amendment, it does not say no natural person. It says no person. And the Supreme Court, for 500 years in British law and then American law, there were two kinds of persons. There were artificial persons, corporations, churches, and governments, and there were natural persons, you and me, human beings. And when the 14th Amendment did not say natural person, instead it said person, even though the sentence begins with a way that you would think is just like, you know, so obvious that this is talking about human beings. I mean, just consider this. Here it is. All persons born, we're talking about a human being, right? All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any persons within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, that sounds like we're talking about human beings. But because it says any person, rather than any natural person, the Supreme Court, starting in 1886, and they didn't actually rule this way in 1886, it's just that John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the court reporter, wrote it into the headnote. But within a decade, they'd actually ruled that this was the case. They said, gee, if it says person there in the 14th Amendment, that must include corporations. Corporations as they exist today didn't even exist when the Constitution was written. The modern corporate form did not exist. It came into being in the middle of the 19th century. And so once it came into being, they went about trying to grab personhood powers. So really what we need to do is simply go in. I mean, the simple way to do it would be to say we're going to amend the 14th Amendment to put the word natural before the word person. And that's going to blow up 120 and change of Supreme Court handing more and more and more powers to corporations. And
right, then that's what we need to do.
Right, and then Congress can actually pass a law saying we're going to limit the amount of money that can go into campaigns. Then Congress can pass laws like we had in every state in the Union up until the 1890s. Every state in the Union had laws that made it illegal to buy politicians, that made it a crime for a corporation to give money to political campaigns or try in any way to influence any election under any circumstances. The officers of the corporations would go to jail for years, under these old laws. These all got overthrown with this idea of corporate personhood. So rather than opening up the Constitution, or rather than passing a half-assed constitutional amendment that says, you know, we're going to give Congress the ability to limit the amount of money in elections, which is what Lawrence Lessig is also suggesting and what Dylan Radigan is suggesting, I say go right to the root of this plant of this weed and chop out the root, which is corporate personhood. Put the word natural before the word person in the 14th Amendment. Explicitly say corporations are not people, money is not speech. Thank you, Marcel.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. It just blows my mind how many people are jumping on these various bandwagons, and everybody's trying to get their own thing, and it's like weird. For the sane among us, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is in the studio with us.
I am.
So nice to see you.
So nice to see you. Steny Hoyer, who, of course, is the minority whip, the Democratic.
Right. He's number two most powerful Democrat in the House of Representatives.
That's right. And Saxby Chambliss, some people think he's the most powerful because of his ability to build coalitions. It's very interesting.
Oh, that's interesting.
But Saxby Chambliss, who, of course, is a Republican senator, they have joined together with many people today, and they said, look, we are asking that this committee, the committee that's
reported,
the Gang of 12, that they go big, and that they not only do revenue increases, i.e. taxes, that they also do real cuts of $4 trillion total in terms of revenue increases and cuts, and that they also look for ways to cut back on waste, fraud, and abuse, and that we want them to really do that. And he also reiterated that there's 100 people in the House from pretty much equal to both sides of the fence that are going against the Grover Norquist pledge, etc. They want some revenue increases. They want to come down a middle ground. On the other hand, of course, there's people that are saying there's no way that there is going to be any kind of agreement on the 23rd. But,
yeah.
Okay. So
we shall see.
So that's on that front. Meanwhile, today, Chuck Schumer, senator from New York, got together, and he said he's putting together a Fix the Guns Checks Act. And what he wants to do is he had people with him who had also been wounded when Gabby Giffords was wounded. And they are calling for much more strict ability in terms of buying guns. As you know, today in the House is when they're voting on this Guns Act, et cetera. And he said, Schumer said he believes in the right to bear arms, but he believes it's not absolute. We have limits on the First Amendment, but there are also reasonable limits on the Second Amendment. And, of course, the Republicans were going after him, saying, well, there's Charles Grassley said there are terrific events, horrific events in Houston, still fresh in our memories, but we need to move forth on bipartisan legislation, but we also have to protect the veterans so that they can carry guns.
What?
Hey.
Because you're a veteran, you should be able to carry a gun?
Just report the news.
Okay.
Right. Your job is to comment on. Okay.
All right.
Trouble in River City with a capital T as we go off to Afghanistan.
Hmm.
There was another drone attack, I think almost 12 people today. They say they got really bad guys who are responsible for the Taliban, etc. Meanwhile, President Karzai had a meeting of Afghan leaders today, and he said, look, we're willing to work with NATO, but the future of the NATO presence requires an end to any nighttime raids. So,
wow.
And also Pakistan also then came in. So this is sort of a coordinated attack between the two. And Pakistan said, well, you know, we love the billion or $2 billion or $3 billion that we're getting, but we really want a level playing field in terms of trade. And so that's what we want more. So they're getting some heat, as I would say, from both what's going on. Karzai's sort of fluffing up his wings, and Pakistan is fluffing up theirs.
Right. And the Taliban, I mean, the thing that Americans need to know is that the Taliban had nothing to do with 9/11. And, you know, the Taliban never declared war on us. And it's like at some point they're going to have to bring these people in. And, in fact, the Taliban was starting to fracture at the time of 9/11. The movement was falling apart within Afghanistan. Internal opposition to the religious
extremism. But we came in and solidified them.
We did. And that's, again, if we were to bomb Iran, I think the same thing would happen. We would just be feeding the crazies. It's like, don't feed the crazies.
Well, you know, it's also interesting, by the way, France did recall its ambassador to Syria. So the Syrians, and there were supposedly spontaneous going after the UAE embassy and the embassy of Morocco in Damascus, going after them for their position on the Arab League. But this is, of course, spontaneous. We all know it was about spontaneous as whatever. Okay. The State Department, today at the briefing, the spokesperson there said that that they denied that politics influenced their decision on the pipeline. Basically, what they're saying is that they didn't anticipate finishing their valuation to the year 2013, that politics has absolutely nothing to do with it, that the White House also has had no bearing on the decision-making process with the TransCanada issue. And then he was asked, interestingly enough, that the spokesperson was asked to respond to claims that denying a permit for the pipeline would result in oil being shipped to Canada. And he said it would not be responsible for simply to focus on one area. By the way, speaking of our dear friends in China, they bought a little more U.S. debt last month. They increased their debt holdings in the United States by 1%. Now, that may not seem much, but again, 1% every month is a lot of percent.
Starts adding up a lot, yeah. And they're sitting on a lot of U.S. Well, and also it says that they're not divesting themselves of U.S. debt, and which tells me that nobody thinks the United States is going to default.
Right. Yeah, and actually, that's exactly what one of the reads was, is that they have confidence in the U.S., that they still like our debt, and they still want to buy into it.
Yeah. I mean, they got to park their money someplace.
Right.
And parking it in U.S. dollars in U.S. treasuries.
Well, we've never really defaulted.
No, we never have. And
we're in a lot better shape than our friends in the European Union.
Yes. Yes. We don't have individual states calling for secession. Well, Rick Perry maybe, but nobody takes him seriously.
Right.
And there's that secession movement up in Vermont, but I don't think that they get taken so seriously. Anyhow,
a couple other interesting things. My brother's group, the Center for Constitutional Rights, filed a FOIA lawsuit. Now, as much as I've been in the Gulf, I didn't really follow this. There was an FBI guy who started a group, which I actually saw their work for, Common Ground. They lent people tools, this, that, the other. Well, it turns out the guy was an FBI informant.
Huh.
His name was Brandon Darby. And at the same time he was developing this community thing, he was informing to the FBI. So the Center for Constitutional Rights and Loyola University want the FBI records on this guy to find out why he was informing. I mean, here you have a good community group after Katrina, and you have the FBI in there getting
incredible.
You can't make this stuff up.
No, you can't. Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Greg Palast is on the line with us. He has a new book out, the investigative journalist, BBC reporter, author of his new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. You can find it all at gregpalast.com/vulturespicnic. And Greg, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you, Tom. You haven't evicted me yet.
It is great to have you with us, and you're looking great, Greg. Let's start at the beginning Actually, I'd like to start in the middle with this. We have an election coming up, and you talk about election shenanigans in the United States in your book. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, it's a book about why we occupy. It's an investigation of the 1%, and it is, you know, basically the number one donor. It's about money poisoning. This is why we occupy. It's an investigation of the 1%. So, for example, the number one new donor to the Republican Party is a guy named Paul the Vulture Singer. And by the way, Rick Perry wanted me to change the name of the book from Vulture's Picnic to Job Creator's Picnic. But I'm going to stick with Vulture's Picnic and tell you about Paul the Vulture Singer.
Yeah.
Okay. He has grabbed the economy through the use of intimidation. Vultures have used bribery, blackmail. I just came back from Bosnia where I uncovered a bribery scheme. These guys get a hold of old debts owed by poor nations and poor people in America. And then they squeeze, not to get the debts paid, but they squeeze to get 100 times what they paid for it. I just came back from the Congo where there is a cholera epidemic. And this guy, this is the one percenter. This is the job creator. This is the number one donor to the Republican Party, Paul Singer. You'll see in Vulture's Picnic, and one of the guys that I hunt down. And you'll meet this job creator who is basically, as the Deputy Secretary of the United Nations has said to me, his job is killing babies. That's, of course, that creates some jobs, I suppose. But that's the name. That's why we occupy. And by the way, I just got a call from BBC. If you go to BBC television tonight, I'll have a story in the front of the news on these vultures. Singer's boys just called to say they have a file on Greg Palast. Well, read Vulture's Picnic and you get the file on Paul the Vulture Singer, the 1%. That's the point. We have to know why we're there. It's not about real estate. It's not about tents or tarps or anything else. In fact, I was just down at the occupation. Our cameraman, Zach Roberts, go to gregpalace.com. You'll see the nightstick just as it's hitting the lens and smashing our camera.
Wow.
But that's not what it's about. It's about them and us. And, like, for example, I just want to give you one example from the book. Jennifer Craig and her mom were burnt alive in California because a gas pipe exploded. What I found out in my investigation is that the big pipeline companies, including British Petroleum, use what's called a pig in a pipeline. Okay, that the pipeline inspection gauge, it goes beep and boop when there's corrosion or leaks and it's about to explode. Right? Mm-hmm. Well, insiders inside the oil company operation that program this robot said that the pig was silenced. It was kind of dialed down because every time it beeps and boops under law, they have to replace the pipe. So the pig was dialed down. So the pipe blew up, burnt these people. And now they want to run a pipe, and they're telling it's going to be safe, Tom, because they're going to run a pipe now from Canada down to Houston. No problem, because the number one safety tool that they have is the pig, and they've silenced the pig electronically. That's why we occupy.
It's like turning off the smoke detector and then wondering why the house burned down and nobody noticed it.
Yeah, because it's cheaper. You know, at nuclear plants, if it says something starts beeping, and that's the other thing. I have a chapter on Fukushima. I actually have. You know, I used to be an investigator before as an investigative reporter. In Vulture's Picnic is a chapter about Fukushima. Mm-hmm. I have the engineer's notebooks from the designer of the nuclear plant, from builder, Stone Webster. Mm-hmm. Every engineer keeps a record. Went back to my 1986 records. There I have the actual engineer's log that says, and this is a quote, "No way can this plant withstand an earthquake." That's a quote.
Yeah, when I read that in your book, you actually included that in the fact that you had these files in your office in the Twin Towers before 9/11.
And thank God that I skirted some of the rules by bringing some of those files home. Thank God I did, because my whole giant file set obviously went down. But we have the notebooks from the engineers. No way can this plant withstand an earthquake. You got to see this stuff. That's the point. We're getting caught up in the tents and Zach got a little whack on the head. Maybe it knocked some sense into him in our operation. But I got to tell you, it's not about the cameras or the whack. It is about the pig in the pipeline. It's about they knew that Fukushima could not withstand an earthquake. And it's about guys like Paul the Vulture Singer who are, according to the UN diplomat, in the baby-killing business.
That's how is Paul Singer in the baby-killing business?
Well, here's how the game is played. I just came back from the Congo last week. There's a cholera epidemic. They need
Which
clean
kills
water.
Children faster than anybody else because it dehydrates. So you can die from cholera in two or three days.
It's horrific. Okay, so what happened was Congo is a very, very rich country. They just can't get all their riches. They sold some cobalt. They got $80 million. There's two Congos. The other Congo sold some oil. And they were going to use this money to UNICEF. I was talking with UNICEF. They were going to use the money to clean up the water systems to prevent the cholera.
Right.
But these vultures used loopholes in the law. And they used support of a guy named George Bush who helped them with this. They used loopholes in law to legally seize the shipments or seize the money earned from the shipments that was supposed to go to clean up the water. So
American businessmen messing in the Congo?
Well, yeah, and let me tell you, again, not just an American businessman, the billionaire who's the number one funder now for the Republican causes, Paul the Vulture, number one. It's not
the Koch brothers. It's a guy that you've never heard of, Paul Singer.
It's a guy, and by the way, the Koch brothers are in there too. They made their money similar way. I should go back with just finishing up on
sure.
Singer.
Yeah, we got 2.5 minutes here.
Is that this guy? Okay. His activities are illegal in Britain and most of Europe. You can't do this stuff. You can't just seize money that is effectively going to aid these countries and take the aid money. The reason that they can even seize anything is that you and I have written off billions of dollars in debt. George Bush did a whole big song and dance of writing off African debt, knowing that the real beneficiary would not be the Africans, but his number one donors. And by the way, he was personally confronted by my report on vultures. Personally confronted by John Conyers in the Oval Office, who said, what about this? This right. stuff is part of it. The bribery stuff is illegal. Singer didn't.
And what did he say?
He was one of his friends. But you get in Vulture's Picnic, you do this.
What did Bush say when you confronted him with this?
What did Bush say? He said, oh, it was the Bush defense. I don't know nothing about it. Of course, that's what he said about everything. So Conyers said, now you know. And by the way, Mr. President, I'm a lawyer. And one of Singer's cronies is called Goldfinger. I kid you not. He makes the real Goldfinger look like a Girl Scout. He said Goldfinger was paying bribes to the president of Zambia to shaft that nation. And what happened was, Conyers said, that's a crime.
Right.
So they did have, Bush actually had the FBI contact me.
It's the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, I think it's called.
Yeah. So yeah, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So we got the little bit of pretend investigation by the FBI.
Right.
But the game continues. I just went to Bosnia where Goldfinger, you see the stuff in the book, the stakeouts we do. We have to find these guys, not so easy. Get inside their file cabinets to
right.
see how the Bush boys, the GOP.
Oh, I know. It's you and I, correspond from time to time in
yeah.
email, and I've been getting these. I really keep wanting to go on the air and say, I just got an email from Greg Pals. He's in Bosnia, or I just got. I can't tell you where he is, but it's amazing the research that you did for this book, and it is a mind-boggling read. It's called Vulture's Picnic, and available in bookstores nationwide and on all the usual suspects and sites and whatnot. And you want to read this. Vulture's Picnic in Pursuit of Petroleum, Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. More information at gregpalast.com. Greg, thank you.
You're the best, Tom.
You too, Greg.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's a spectacular book. Greg Palast is one of the best investigative journalists on Earth.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud. Paleoanthropology, how we evolve.
Welcome back. This is my my moment in the week, once a week, where for about 3 minutes I'll share with you my favorite science story. This actually Jacob shared with me, and this is super cool. Male nursery spiders... Nursery web spiders, they're called, basically pay for mating by giving gifts. So the male brings something wrapped up in spider web and gives it to the female, and the female unwraps it and assumes that there's going to be a tasty bug in there. And while she's unwrapping it, the male is having his way with her, as they used to say. And what they found was that a lot of these males were actually not going out and finding a bug and wrapping it up. They were just taking a piece of dried leaf or a piece of dirt or something and wrapping it up. And the females would fall for it. And they thought, this is weird. How is this, but then what they discovered was that the females, as soon as they figured out that there wasn't a bug in there, they got rid of the male. So sometimes literally. So it's just fascinating. I find spiders fascinating. Anyway, back to, as Greg said, this isn't about his comment was the Occupy Wall Street movement, or his book actually, Vulture's Picnic, Vulture's Picnic is not about the 99% movement or the Occupy Wall Street movement as much as it is the book about the 1% and what they're up to. And my point from the previous hour is that we are now in a revolutionary moment in American history. And it's going to take a few years in all probability, but you never know. Sometimes revolutions happen really, really fast. And, you know, when Eric Honecker was demanding that his secret police in East Germany kill people, and they finally said, no, not going to do it. We're not going to man the checkpoints. We're not going to shoot people as they try to jump over the fence. Poof. The system crumbled. So I think, you know, one of the biggest questions as an American is, if we are in a revolutionary moment, is the revolution going to happen by virtue of the system collapsing? In other words, we get into something that's even worse, another economic great crash. Is there going to be a collapse, a nationwide collapse? Frankly, I think it's going to be a worldwide collapse. Or are we going to fix things before that happens? And I'm hopeful about the latter, but I'm concerned about the former, because a lot of people will get hurt in a full-out collapse. But I really believe it's going to happen. And I think we're halfway into it. And the reason why I think it's going to happen is because we haven't changed the fundamentals. People used to have careers in America, now they have jobs. People used to have health care with no deductibles in America, now they're getting screwed by the big insurance companies that are paying their CEOs millions. People used to have pensions in America, where they knew that they could retire and just live off their retirement forever. Now, nada. I mean, it's really quite astounding how bad things have gotten in this country, where you have 53 million people without health insurance, 44 million people on food stamps, 49 million Americans living in poverty. I mean, it's 300 million Americans. That's like a sixth of the country. So, you know, will the revolution be televised? Not if Mayor Bloomberg has anything to say about it. But I'm telling you, you can't stop it. It is absolutely going to happen. Todd, Santa Barbara. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You were asking about our thoughts on the revolution. I think that increasingly we have no other outlet due to things like voter fraud and caging and corporate voting machines, Citizens United, 94% of elections which have the higher amount of money win the elections. The more our representative government is curtailed, the more we'll be forced into other means and outlets.
Yeah, well, you're talking about a revolution in the streets, as it were, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know if we're going to – I think that that's what we're seeing right now with the Occupy movement is
a
revolution.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think the occupation is – people do – you know, they feel helpless. They don't have – they just don't feel like they have – they're not making a dent –
right.
Or they're not making an impact with their voting rights, and they have to seek other means.
Yes, and they are seeking other means, and frankly, I think it's working. I think that it's drawing a lot of attention. It has changed the national dialogue. It's changing the national conversation. Thank you, Todd, for your comment. It's very well said. This is, you know, in 1967, there were horrible riots in Watts and Detroit there in the mid-60s. Horrible riots. Martin Luther King addressed these. Here's what he had to say about the riots and who was responsible for them.
And the only thing that can be done now is for the nation to move on aggressively to get rid of the intolerable conditions that bring riots into being. We've got to condemn riots, but as we condemn them, we must be just as forthright in condemning the conditions that bring them into being and condemning the Congress of our nation, which can spend $80 million a day to fight a war, which I consider an unjust one, in Vietnam, and yet cannot even or refuses to pass a $44 million bill to get rid of the rats in the ghettos of our nation. I think the culprit must be pointed out. And the culprit in this situation is not merely the one with the Molotov cocktail, but the culprit is the Congress, is the recalcitrance of white society, the vacillation and ambivalence of white America on the whole question of genuine equality for the black man.
There you go. And we're there again, I believe. Not with the riots yet. And hopefully we don't get to the riots. But we're there at that point where people are saying, enough. 30 years of Reaganomics has destroyed this country. Enough. Time to choose a different course. A more positive and a more progressive course.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the vocabulary word ugly. And your calls and thoughts right after this. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very petitiently ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good. Lansing Mayor Virge Bonero. As mayors from around America dispatch their police forces to evict Occupy movements, Mayor Bonero in Lansing, Michigan, is doing things a bit differently. He's welcoming the Occupy movement. Last month, Mayor Bonero spoke at an Occupy Lansing rally and has continued cooperative and cordial relations with the occupiers ever since. As the mayor's executive assistant said, I think that our Occupy protest has been a model for the country in both the way they've conducted themselves and the relationship we've established with them. I think Mayor Bloomberg in New York City could learn a few things from Lansing, Michigan, my old hometown. The bad, Rick Perry. With the wheels ready to come off the Rick Perry presidential campaign at any moment, Governor Goodhair stopped by New Hampshire today for a town hall event. And it looks like Perry put Sheriff Joe Arpaio in charge of security. As people were asked at the door if they were U.S. citizens. Apparently no foreigners were allowed in. The Perry campaign clarified the policy and said that non-U.S. citizens would be allowed in as long as they are monitored by an official with the company hosting the event at all times. This is bad on numerous levels. One, voters and journalists shouldn't have to bring proof of citizenship just to ask Governor Perry a question. Two, anyone should be able to see how our democracy works. We're supposed to be the democratic model for the rest of the world, right? And three, let's see, the third one, I can't, oops. And the very, very ugly, U.S. District Judge Henry Windgate, Mississippi resident Anita McLemore and her two kids are three of the 44 million people in America who depend on food stamps to get enough food to eat. Unfortunately, when Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it back in 1996, a new federal law was created that forbids anyone who's been convicted of a drug-related felony from receiving food stamp benefits for life. So with her and her kids facing starvation, Anita McLemore, who has been convicted of drug charges in the past, lied on her application to receive benefits. And U.S. District Judge Henry Windgate figured lying to feed your family should get you 3.5 years behind bars. That's what he sentenced McLemore to last week. As Think Progress reported, also last week, a bankster who perpetrated a $3 million mortgage fraud scandal in Mississippi was sentenced to just 2.5 years in prison. So to recap, lying on the application to feed your starving family gets you a prison term 1 year longer than running a multi-million dollar mortgage scam. There's something really screwed up with our criminal justice system, and that's very, very ugly. That's mind-boggling. I don't know, how do you say that beyond that? Carrie in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Carrie, what's on your mind today? Carrie? Do we have the volume up? No, Carrie. All righty. Let's see. Cliff in Santa Clarita. Hey, Cliff, what's on your mind today?
Oh, greeting, Brother Tom.
Hello, Cliff.
Those economic statistics that you were throwing out there really are staggering. And also, I didn't know that I ate so many vegetables growing up. It's really good news.
You mean all that pizza?
French fries.
And French fries, yeah.
Anyways.
This is Reaganomics all over again. I mean, it's just it's incredible. The Republicans all want to go back to Reagan.
Well, they want to create their own fantasy world. It's just not attached to reality. It's just ridiculous. Anyways, back when the protests in England and the streets were turning ugly and violent, I called you to ask your opinion as to what our government's reaction would be if protests hit our streets, if our government would react violently and crack down with force.
Mm-hmm.
well, it looks like we have our answer, right?
Well, yes and no. In Lansing, Michigan, you've got a government cooperating. In Santa Rosa, they're
right.
Cooperating. In Oakland, you know, you had a mayor who I think took some very bad advice and now is really, really regretting it. And as Joshua Holland pointed out, when the second time that they cleared the park, they did it completely peacefully and slowly and gently, as opposed to the first time when they came in with the flashbang grenades and the tear gas and all that kind of stuff. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes. But this, Cliff, I'm telling you, this is a revolutionary moment, and I don't mean in terms of violent revolution. I mean in terms of this is, you know, the Reagan Revolution was a silent revolution. The Great Society was a not-so-silent revolution. It was a response in large part to the civil rights movement, which was loud and in our face. And that's what this movement is, too. And it's going to produce change. You cannot not have change as a result of that. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I just want to let you know that for past 3 months, I've been a new viewer of Free Speech TV, and I just got your book, made a donation to get you a Tom Hartman reader. That's wonderful.
Oh, great. Well, thank you.
I encourage everybody to do that. Now a thought. Tom,
your
revolution has begun. You're so correct. It will not be televised. Now we ought to hold our congressional representatives in Washington, D.C. accountable for reflecting needs of the people, as well as our elected officials in regarding the President of the United States. To hold them accountable for representing the voice of the people, and the military and the police take their orders from our representatives.
Right, from the civilian authorities.
What? Yeah, that's exactly right. So guess what? They are running scared at this present moment. They are afraid that the voice of the people, the corporations.
I think the entire power structure is running scared right now, and they're feeling the pressure of being exposed. I don't think the Koch brothers, they were running ALEC and all these other things, Heritage Foundation, Cato, all this stuff for decades, and nobody ever mentioned it. They were invisible, they were giving out all this money and all these things, and now it's like out, right? And so they're. They're getting public and they're getting defensive. No, I think you're spot on, Michael. And thank you very much for the call. Very well said. Dave in Grandy, Massachusetts. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, it's good to talk to you. I'm kind of pessimistic because I think that unless all the energy of the protests and everything results in Democratic wins in the next election coming up in 2012, then it'll really all be for nothing.
It has to be more than just Democratic wins. It has to be major progressive wins. It has to be a significant shift in the progress in the direction in a populist and progressive direction.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I'll tell you, if the Republicans can hold on to the Congress and flip just a few seats in the Senate, which is not unthinkable because there are three Democratic open seats in Virginia, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. If that happens, it won't even matter if Obama gets reelected next year.
Well, it hard to say. And it's hard to say how things are going to go and who's going to get elected. And I don't want to be being bummed out right now about what might happen a year from now. I think it's more important that we get out there, we get active, we show up, we participate. And let's see what happens. But in the meantime, change is happening right now as we speak. And this is, more than any other time, now is the time to be contacting your local elected officials. They have local offices, your member of Congress, your two senators, to get to know who is your state representative, who is your state senator, contact your governor's office, and in particular, show up with movement politics, go to pdamerica.org and join Progressive Democrats of America, go to Democracy for America, Jim Dean's organization, go through one of their trainings in activism and how to get out there, show up at the Democratic Party events, show up at the Republican Party events for that matter. Let's take over the whole damn thing. Now is the time to participate. Dave, thank you for the call and for an excellent comment. David in New York City. Hey, David.
Yeah, Hi, Tom. We talked before. Yeah, I just think what actually happened at the right time for the movement, especially the way Bloomberg did it with the beating up of congressmen
He wasn't a congressman. He was a city councilor.
City councilman. I meant to say councilman. I'm sorry. But what was happening? I mean, I've been down there a number of times, and even a lot of the occupiers were getting over it because what happens in these encampments, of course, as the weather gets colder, you're going to attract more and more people that are desperate, homeless, mentally ill, and that was taking over. And once that takes over, then it gives the right wing spotlight to say, see, they're nothing but the dirty hippies.
Right.
So now they're moving. They have offices now. They there's a lot of creative ways that this can be done, like you said, with the Karl Rove standing up, occupying these certain meetings, occupying certain places, you know.
Yep.
And I think this will stay alive, and then we can get the major, major marches happening in the spring where everybody sits down, does civil disobedience, and demands jury trials.
Yeah.
That's what's really going to change things.
There you go. There you go. And yes, let's hold people accountable. Let's hold the banksters accountable, and on it goes. Colleen in Sebastopol, California. Hey, Colleen, what's up?
Well, good day to you. We had a lovely meeting at the Sebastopol City Council meeting. This is in Sonoma County.
Mm-hmm.
And just as the city of Santa Rosa has learned from the mistakes of Oakland and other areas, and they're trying to do the best thing that they can, they're having a little trouble with some of the terms and conditions of the permit process. Now, in Sebastopol, we've had a community member who's a lawyer who has stepped in to interface with the city. Mm-hmm. And the city council member, Sarah Gurney put forth a resolution adding some solidarity, and mm-hmm. we're going to have a community sing-along on Saturday. So we really are a model for that, and I think the roots come from once upon a time we were the first city to have a Green Party majority, even though
really?
It's nonpartisan.
Yeah.
Yes, so what I'd like to see is, well, first of all, this revolution, the positive parts aren't televised, but they are transmitted on AM radio airwaves and the internet. And
yep.
would you help us hold our members responsible here? Boxers from Oakland, Feinstein's husband, Richard Blooms, on the Regents Board of UC, and, you know, Berkeley's having trouble. The Regents
right.
canceled their meetings. So let's hear
I think you just, you and all of our listeners, I mean, you just broadcast it to all of our listeners, Colleen, and many of them in the Bay Area. Thank you for doing that, and thank you for your call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's 45 minutes past the hour. The process of defection, Chris Hedges writes, among the ruling class and security forces is slow and often imperceptible, but it does happen.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mark Taylor Canfield with an update from Occupy Seattle. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, a couple of things, Tom. We are meeting with Dr. Cornell West at the occupation site in just a few minutes here, so we're really excited about that.
Please give him my best regards. We keynoted the Fighting Bob Fest gig in Madison, Wisconsin together just about a month ago.
Well, I hope sometime you can come and visit us too, Tom, because I think these kinds of meetings are historic, and you're right, we are at a historic movement or moment in this movement. Unfortunately, last night there was a solidarity march. I got pepper sprayed. An 84-year-old woman got pepper sprayed by the Seattle police.
Oh.
A pregnant woman was hospitalized after being pepper sprayed by the police, and a priest was pepper sprayed by the police. And once again, they're using these tactics against peaceful, nonviolent, Gandhian followers of Martin Luther King Jr. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
Our city council endorsed us as a movement and accepted most of our demands, and yet our police department is using pepper spray to stop people from dancing, and I don't understand it. It took place last night during a solidarity march in solidarity with the folks that got kicked out of Zuccotti Park. And for some reason, they've used pepper spray all day long, and I think that they've made another big mistake that's not going to hurt their, or it's not going to help their cause at all, because once the media gets a hold of that the Seattle Police Department has been pepper spraying pregnant women at protests, I don't think it's going to look good for them.
Yeah.
And I wish that everybody would just call their mayor's office, call the police department, call your city council especially, and tell them to stop violently dealing with these peaceful protesters around the country, because really this is our free right to freedom of speech and assembly, and if we don't have that, Tom, what do we have?
Yeah. And we have to use that to make this country work. I mean, it's like it's been hijacked by a small band of plutocrats. Mark, thank you for the update, and give my best to everybody there. That's a tough one. James in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Well, you mentioned the increasing militarization of the police, and that certainly continued apace in my lifetime. I wanted to say it seems ominous to me in view of the fact that even putatively Democratic mayors now seem to be in contact with mayors around the country about how to handle the movement.
The militarization of the police actually started during the Reagan administration, and it was pushed by the defense contractors as a way of creating demand for more military goods, basically. And it was the Pentagon taking surplus goods and giving them to police departments. And then it went from here's our leftovers to police departments buying directly from the defense contractors. Now they have trade shows, and now it's no longer the military industrial complex. Now it's the military state security police complex, industrial complex.
Well, also with the mayors in contact with each other.
Yes.
Now the mayor of Oakland should only be concerned with the local effects in Oakland. This smacks of a conspiracy to put down a political movement.
Well, the mayor of Oakland, Jean Kwan, has said, and I think it was in an unguarded moment, that she was on a conference call with 18 other city officials around the country who were facing similar situations, in other words, occupations. Let's give that the most charitable interpretation possible, that they were trying to figure out appropriate ways to respond to the needs, the genuine needs for security and safety and whatnot of people who are choosing to protest and occupy the streets. I would much prefer to believe that than to believe that they were, and frankly, I doubt that at the level of mayor that they're comparing police state tactics. And in fact, since that first police state crash in the first police riot in Oakland, the police have been very, very radically dialed back. And so it might be a good thing that the mayors are talking to each other. So let's not go all paranoid here.
Well, yes. Okay. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Larry in Williamsburg, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Well, these Republicans are so against abortion and stuff, but yet they're taking money from that. Paul Singer, a guy who is letting these babies die. Now, isn't that a little hypocritical?
I don't think anybody has ever failed politically by... I'm trying to phrase this in a cute way, and there's no cute way to phrase it. Republicans are hypocrites. I mean, it's just they run on family values, and then they want to cut Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. It just doesn't get more hypocritical than that. Thank you, Larry, for the call. Robert in Brookfield, New Hampshire. Hey, Robert, we got a minute. We have a minute to the end of the show. It's all yours.
All right, I'll make it real quick. Just getting back to the second paragraph in the Declaration of Independence, and basically to me, it says that the people have the right to overthrow their government when they no longer represent them. 99% of the people no longer feel the government represents them, and I think we should overthrow the government.
Well, they don't use the word overthrow. They use the word alter or abolish.
Alter, okay.
And I think that abolish is not appropriate. It's not going to happen. And alter is entirely appropriate, and that's why I'm calling for a constitutional amendment that says that corporations aren't people and money isn't speech. And that puts the word.
And I agree with you.
Yeah.
And I think that later on in the paragraph, it actually talks about how to make those changes without a constitutional amendment.
Yeah. And keep in mind that actually I don't think that there is a way to make those changes without a constitutional amendment. But on the other hand, there are some people who are having some significant successes without the constitutional amendment. So that's a conversation that we'll continue to have. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, tomorrow is the two-month anniversary of the Occupy movement. The organizers are calling for a day of action. We'll have all the latest information, plus the best of the rest of the news in your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.